Side 12.
An awful thought came to me today. They would have suspected GP. Caroline is bound to give the police his name. Poor man. He'll be sarcastic and they won't like it. I've been trying to draw him today. Strange. It's hopeless. Nothing like him. I know he's short. Only an inch or two more than me. I've always dreamed tall men. Silly. He's going bald and has a nose like a Jew's, though he isn't. Not that I'd mind if he was. And the face is too broad. Battered, worn. Battered and worn and pitted into a bit of a mask. So that I never quite believe whatever expression it's got on. I glimpse things I think must have come from behind. But I'm never very sure. He puts on a special dry face for me sometimes. I see it go on. It doesn't seem dishonest, though. It seems just GP. Life is a bit of a joke. It's silly to take it seriously. Be serious about art, but joke a little about everything else. Not the day when the H-bombs drop, but the day of the great fry-up. When the great fry-up takes place.
Sick.
It's his way of being healthy. Short and broad, and broad-faced with a hook nose. Even a bit Turkish. Not really English-looking at all. I have this silly notion about English good looks. Advertisement men. Ladymont men. October 27th. The tunnel round the door is my best bet. I feel I must try it soon. I think I've worked out a way of getting him away. I've been looking very carefully at the door this afternoon. It's wood, faced with iron on this side, terribly solid. I could never break it down or lever it open. He's made sure there's nothing to break and lever with in any case. I've begun to collect some tools. A tumbler I can break. That will be something sharp. A fork and two teaspoons. They're aluminium, but they might be useful. What I need most is something strong and sharp to pick out the cement between the stones with. Once I can make a hole through them, it shouldn't be too difficult to get round into the outer cellar. This makes me feel practical. Businesslike. But I haven't done anything. I feel more hopeful. I don't know why, but I do. October 28th. GP is an artist. Caroline's second-rate Paul Nash. Horrid. But there's something in it. Nothing like what he would call photography, but not absolutely individual. I think it's just that he arrived at the same conclusions. And either he sees that his landscapes have a Nashy quality, or he doesn't. Either way, it's a criticism of him. That he neither sees it, nor says it. And being objective about him, his faults. His hatred of abstract painting, even of people like Jackson Pollock and Nicholson. Why? I'm more than half convinced intellectually by him, but I still feel some of the paintings he says are bad are beautiful. I mean, he's too jealous. He condemns too much. I don't mind this. I'm trying to be honest about him and about myself. He hates people who don't think things through, and he does it too much. But he has, except over women, principles. He makes most people with so-called principles look like empty tin cans. I remember he once said about a Mondrian, "It isn't whether you like it, but whether you ought to like it." I mean, he dislikes abstract art on principle. He ignores what he feels. I've been leaving the worst to last. Women. It must have been about the fourth or fifth time I went round to see him. There was the Nielsen woman. I suppose now they'd been to bed together. I was so naive. But they didn't seem to mind my coming. They needn't have answered the bell. And she was rather nice to me in her glittery at home sort of way. Must be 40. What could he see in her? Then, a long time after that, it was May, and I'd been the night before, but he was out or in bed with someone. And that evening he was in and alone, and we talked some time. He was telling me about John Minton, and then he put on an Indian record and we were quiet. But he didn't shut his eyes that time. He was looking at me, and I was embarrassed. When the raga ended, there was a silence. I said, "Shall I turn it?" But he said no. He was in the shadow. I couldn't see him very well. Suddenly he said, "Would you like to come to bed?" I said, "No, I wouldn't." He caught me by surprise, and I sounded foolish, frightened. He said, his eyes still on me, 10 years ago, I would have married you. You would have been my second disastrous marriage." It wasn't really a surprise. It had been waiting for weeks. He came and stood by me. "You're sure?" I said, "I haven't come here for that, at all." It seemed so unlike him. So crude. I think now, I know now, he was being kind, deliberately obvious and crude. Just as he sometimes lets me beat him at chess. He went to make Turkish coffee, and he said through the door, "You're misleading." I went and stood in the kitchen door while he watched the Vriki. He looked back at me. "I could swear you want it sometimes." "How old are you?" I said. "I could be your father. Is that what you mean?" "I hate promiscuity," I said. "I didn't mean that." He had his back turned to me. I felt angry with him. He seemed so irresponsible. I said, "Anyhow, you don't attract me that way in the least." He said, with his back still turned, "What do you mean by promiscuity?" I said, "Going to bed for pleasure. Sex and nothing else. Without love." He said, "I'm very promiscuous then. I never go to bed with the people I love. I did once." I said, "You warned me against Barbara Cruikshank." "I'm warning you against myself now," he said. He stood watching the Vriki. "You know the Ashmolean Uccello? The hunt? No? The design hits you the moment you see it, apart from all the other technical things. You know, it's faultless. The professors, with middle European names, spend their lives working out what the great inner secret is. That thing you feel at the first glance. Now I see you have the great inner secret, too. God knows what it is. I'm not a middle European professor. I don't really care how it is. But you have it. You're like Sheraton joinery. You won't fall apart." He spoke it all in a very matter-of-fact voice, too. "It's hazard, of course," he said. "The genes." He lifted the Vriki off the gas ring at the last possible moment. "The only thing is," he said, "there's that scarlet point in your eye." "What is it? Passion? Stop?" He stood staring at me, the dry look. "It's not bed," I said. "But for someone... for no one." I sat on the divan, and he on his high stool by the bench. "I've shocked you," he said. "I was warned." "By aunt?" "Yes." He turned and very slowly, very carefully, poured the coffee into the cups. He said, "All my life I've had to have women. They've mostly brought me unhappiness. The most has been brought by the relationship that was supposed to be pure and noble. There," he pointed at a photo of his two sons, "that's the fine fruit of a noble relationship." I went and got my coffee and leant against the bench away from him. "Robert's only 4 years younger than you are now," he said. "Don't drink it yet. Let the ground settle." He didn't seem at ease, as if he had to talk. Be on the defensive, disillusion me and get my sympathy at the same time. He said, "Lust is simple. You reach an understanding at once. You both want to get into bed, or one of you doesn't. But love, the women I've loved have always told me I'm selfish. It's what makes them love me, and then be disgusted with me. Do you know what they always think is selfishness?" He was scraping the glue away from a broken Chinese blue and white bowl he'd bought in the Portobello Road, and repaired. Two fiendishly excited horsemen chasing a timid little fallow deer. Very short-fingered, sure hands. "Not that I will paint in my own way, live in my own way, speak in my own way. They don't mind that. It even excites them.
But what they can't stand is that I hate them when they don't behave in their own way.
It was as if I was another man.
People like your bloody aunt think I'm a cynic, a wrecker of homes, a rake. I've never seduced a woman in my life. I like bed. I like the female body. I like the way even the shallowest of women become beautiful when their clothes are off, and they think they're taking a profound and wicked step. They always do the first time. You know what's almost extinct in your sex? He looked sideways at me, so I shook my head. Innocence. The one time you see it is when a woman takes her clothes off and cannot look you in the eyes. As I couldn't then. Just that first Botticelli moment of the first time of her taking her clothes off. Soon shrivels. The old Eve takes over. The strumpet. Exit. Anna Diomene. Who's she? I asked. He explained. I was thinking, I shouldn't let him talk like this. He's drawing a net round me. I didn't think it. I felt it. He said, I've met dozens of women and girls like you. Some I've known well. Some I've seduced against their better nature and my better nature. Two I've even married. Some I've hardly known at all, just stood beside them at an exhibition, in a tube, wherever. After a while, he said, you've read Jung? No, I said. He's given your species of the sex a name. Not that it helps. The disease is just as bad.
Tell me the name, I said.
He said, you don't tell diseases their names. Then there was a strange silence. As if we'd come to a full stop. As if he'd expected me to react in some other way. Be more angry or shocked, perhaps. I was shocked and angry afterwards, in a peculiar way. But I'm glad I didn't run away. It was one of those evenings when one grows up. I suddenly knew I had either to behave like a shocked girl who had still been at school that time the year before, or like an adult. You're a weird kid, he said at last. Old-fashioned, I said. He'd be a bloody bore if he weren't so pretty. Thank you. I didn't really expect you to go to bed with me, he said. I know, I said. He gave me a long look. Then he changed. He got out the chessboard, and we played chess, and he let me beat him. He wouldn't admit it, but I'm sure he did. We hardly said anything. We seemed to communicate through the chessmen. There was something very symbolic about my winning, that he wished me to feel. I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it was that he wanted me to see my virtue triumph over his vice, or something subtler, that sometimes losing is winning. The next time I went, he gave me a drawing he'd done. It was of the Vrykhi and the two cups on the bench. Beautifully drawn. Absolutely simple. Absolutely without fuss or nervousness. Absolutely free of that clever art student look the drawings of simple objects I do have. Just the two cups and the little cup of Vrykhi and his hand, or a hand, lying by one of the cups like a plaster cast. On the back he wrote, Après, and the date, and then, Pour une princesse lointaine. The une was very heavily underlined. I wanted to go on about Toinette, but I'm too tired. I want to smoke when I write, but it makes the air so stuffy. October 29th. Morning. He's gone into Lewis. Toinette. It was a month after the evening of the record. I ought to have guessed. She'd been purring over me for days, giving me arch looks. I thought it was something to do with Piers. And then one evening I rang the bell, and then I noticed the lock was up. So I pushed the door open and looked up the stairs, at the same time as Toinette looked down round the door. And we were looking at each other. After a moment she came out on the landing and she was dressing. She didn't say anything. She just gestured me to come up and into the studio. And what was worst, I was red and she was not. She was just amused.
"Don't look so shocked," she said. "He'll be back in a minute. He's just gone out for..." But I never heard what it was because I went. I've never really analyzed why I was so angry and so shocked and so hurt. Donald, Piers, David, everyone knows she lives in London as she lived in Stockholm. She's told me herself. They've told me. And GP had told me what he was like. It was not just jealousy. It was that someone like GP could be so close to someone like her. Someone so real and someone so shallow, so phony, so loose. But why should he have considered me at all? There's not a single reason. He's 21 years older than I am. 9 years younger than Dee. For days afterwards, it wasn't GP I was disgusted with, but myself. At my narrow-mindedness. I forced myself to meet, to listen to Toinette. She didn't crow at all. I think that must have been GP's doing. He ordered her not to. She went back the next day. She said it was to say she was sorry, and her words, it just happened. I was so jealous. They made me feel older than they were. They were like naughty children, happy with a secret. Then that I was frigid. I couldn't bear to see GP. In the end, it must have been a week later, he rang me up again one evening at Caroline's. He didn't sound guilty. I said I was too busy to see him. I wouldn't go round that evening, no. If he'd pressed, I would have refused. But he seemed to be about to ring off, and I go round the next day. I so wanted him to know I was hurt. You can't be hurt over a telephone. Caroline said, "I think you're seeing too much of him." I said, "He's having an affair with that Swedish girl." We even had a talk about it. I was very fair. I defended him. But in bed, I lay and accused him to myself for hours. The first thing he said the next day was, "No pretending. Has she been a bitch to you?" I said, "No, not at all." Then, as if I didn't care, "Why should she?" He smiled. "I know what you're feeling," he seemed to say. It made me want to slap his face. I couldn't look as if I didn't care, which made it worse. He said, "Men are vile." I said, "The vilest thing about them is that they can say that with a smile on their faces." "That is true," he said. And there was silence. I wished I hadn't come. I wished I'd cut him out of my life. I looked at the bedroom door. It was ajar. I could see the end of the bed. I said, "I'm not able to put life in compartments yet, that's all." "Look, Miranda," he said, "those 20 long years that lie between you and me, I've more knowledge of life than you. I've lived more and betrayed more and seen more betrayed. At your age, one is bursting with ideals. You think that because I can see sometimes what's trivial and what's important in art, I ought to be more virtuous. But I don't want to be virtuous. My charm, if there is any for you, is simply frankness and experience, not goodness. I'm not a good man. Perhaps, morally, I'm younger even than you are. Can you understand that?" He was only saying what I felt. I was stiff, and he was supple. And it ought to be the other way round. The fault all mine. But I kept on thinking he took me to the concert, and he came back here to her. I remembered times when I rang the bell and there'd been no answer. I see now it was all sexual jealousy. But then it seemed a betrayal of principles. I still don't know. It's all muddled in my mind. I can't judge. I said, "I'd like to hear Ravishankar." "I couldn't say I forgive you." So we listened to that. Then played chess, and he beat me. No reference to Toinette, except at the very end on the stairs when he said, "It's all over now." I didn't say anything. "She only did it for fun," he said. But it was never the same. It was a sort of truce. I saw him a few times more, but never alone. I wrote him 2 letters when I was in Spain, and he sent a postcard back. I saw him once at the beginning of this month. But I'll write about that another time. And I'll write about the strange talk I had with the Nielsen woman.
something Toinette said. She said, he talked about his boys, and I felt so sorry for him. How they used to ask him not to go to their posh prep school, but to meet them in the town. Ashamed to have him seen. How Robert at Marlborough patronizes him now. He never talked to me about them. Perhaps he secretly thinks I belong to the same world. A little middle-class boarding school prig. Evening. I tried to draw GP from memory again today. Hopeless. C sat reading The Catcher in the Rye after supper. Several times I saw him look to see how many pages more he had to read. He reads it only to show me how hard he is trying. I was passing the front door tonight, Bath, and I said, well, thank you for a lovely evening. Goodbye now. And I made as if to open the door. It was locked, of course. It seems stuck, I said. And he didn't smile. He just stood watching me. I said, it's only a joke. I know, he said. It's very peculiar. He made me feel a fool, just by not smiling. Of course GP was always trying to get me into bed. I don't know why, but I see that more clearly now than I ever did at the time. He shocked me, bullied me, taunted me, never in nasty ways. Obliquely. He didn't ever force me in any way, touch me. I mean, he's respected me in a queer way. I don't think he really knew himself. He wanted to shock me to him or away from him. He didn't know. Left it to chance. More photos today. Not many. I said it hurt my eyes too much. And I don't like him always ordering me about. He's terribly obsequious. Would I do this? Would I oblige by... No, he didn't say oblige, but it's a wonder he doesn't. You ought to go in for beauty comps, he said, when he was winding up his film. Thank you, I said. The way we talk is mad. I don't see it till I write it down. He talks as if I'm free to go at any minute, and I'm the same. I bet you look smashing in a whatchamacallit, he said. I looked puzzled. One of those French swimming things, he said. A bikini, I asked. I can't allow talk like that. So I stared coldly at him. Is that what you mean? To photograph, like, he said, going red. And the weird thing is, I know he means exactly that. He didn't mean to be nasty. He wasn't hinting at anything, he was just being clumsy, as usual. He meant literally what he said. I would be interesting to photograph in a bikini. I used to think it must be there. It's very deeply suppressed, but it must be there. But I don't anymore. I don't think he's suppressing anything. There's nothing to suppress. October 30th. A lovely night walk. There were great reaches of clear sky. No moon. Sprinkles of warm white stars everywhere, like milky diamonds. And a beautiful wind from the west. I made him take me round and round 10 or 12 times, the branches rustling, an owl hooting in the woods in the sky, wild, all free, all wind and air and space and stars. Wind full of smells and faraway places, hopes. The sea. I'm sure I could smell the sea. I said later, of course, I was gagged outside. Are we near the sea? And he said, 10 miles. I said, near Lewis? He said, I can't say, as if someone else had strictly forbidden him to speak. I often feel that with him. A horrid little cringing good nature dominated by a mean bad one. Indoors, it couldn't have been more different. We talked about his family again. I'd been drinking scrumpy. I do it a little to see if I can get him drunk and careless, but so far he won't touch it. He's not a teetotaler, he says. So it's all part of his waterishness. Won't be corrupted. Tell me some more about your family. Nothing more to tell. It'd interest you. That's not an answer. It's like I said. As I said. I used to be told I was good at English. That was before I knew you. It doesn't matter. I suppose you got the A-level and all that.
Yes, I did.
I got O-level in maths and biology. I was counting stitches. Jumper, expensive French wool. Good. 17, 18, 19. I won a prize for hobbies. Clever you. Tell me more about your father. I told you, he was a representative, stationery and fancy goods. A commercial traveller. They call them representatives now. He got killed in a car crash before the war. Your mother went off with another man. She was no good. Like me. I gave him an icy look. Thank goodness his humour so rarely seeps out. So your aunt took you over? Yes. Like Mrs. Joe and Pip. Oh? Never mind. Oh, she's all right. She kept me out of the orphanage. And your cousin Mabel, you've never said anything about her? She's older than me, 30. Now, there's her elder brother. He went out to Australia after the war to my Uncle Steve. He's a real Australian. Been out there years. I've never seen him. And haven't you any other family? There's relations of Uncle Dick. But they and Aunt Annie never got on. You haven't said what Mabel's like. She's deformed, spastic. Real sharp. Always wants to know everything you've done. She can't walk. About the house, we had to take her out in a chair. Perhaps I've seen her. You haven't missed much. Aren't you sorry for her? Oh, it's like you have to be sorry for her all the time. It's Aunt Annie's fault. Go on. She, like, makes everything round her deformed, too. I can't explain. Like, nobody else had any right to be normal. I mean, she doesn't complain outright. It's just looks she gives, and you have to be dead careful. Suppose, well, I say not thinking one evening, I nearly missed the bus this morning, I had to run like Billy-O. Sure as fate, Aunt Annie would say, think yourself lucky you can run. Mabel wouldn't say anything, she'd just look. How vile. You had to think very careful about what you said. Carefully. I mean, carefully. Why didn't you run away, live in Diggs? I used to think about it. Because they were two women on their own. You were being a gent, being a Charlie, more like it. Pathetic his attempts at being a cynic. And now they're in Australia, making your other relations miserable. I suppose so. Did they write letters? Yes, not Mabel. Would you read one to me one day? What for? I'd be interested. Great inner struggle. I got one this morning. I've got it on me. A lot of argy-bargy. But in the end, he took the letter from out of his pocket. That's stupid. Never mind. Read it out. All of it. He sat by the door, and I knitted. I can't remember the letter word for word, but it was something like this. Dear Fred, that's the name she calls me by, he said. She doesn't like Ferdinand, red with embarrassment. Very pleased to have yours, and as I said in my last, it's your money. God has been very kind to you, and you mustn't fly up in the face of his kindness. And I wish you had not taken this step. Your Uncle Steve says property's more trouble than it's worth. I notice you don't answer my question about the woman to clean. I know what men are, and just remember what they say. Cleanliness is next to godliness. I have no right, and you have been very generous, Fred. Uncle Steve and the boys and Gertie can't understand why you didn't come here with us. Gert only said this morning that you ought to be here. Your place is with us, and don't think I'm not grateful. I hope the Lord will forgive me, but this has been a great experience, and you wouldn't know Mabel. She's brown in the sun here. It's very nice, but I don't like the dust. Everything gets dirty, and they live in a different way to what we do at home. They speak English more like Americans, even Uncle Steve, than us. I shan't be sorry to get home to Blackstone Road. It worries me to think of the damp and the dirt. I hope you did what I said and aired all the rooms and linen, like I said, and got a good cleaning woman in, like I said, the same as with you, I hope. Fred, I'm worried with all that money, you won't lose your head. There are a lot of clever, dishonest people, she means women, he said, about these days. I brought you up as well as I could, and if you do wrong, it's the same as if I did. I shan't show this to Mabel. She says you don't like it. I know you're over age. Over 21, she means, he said. But I worry about you because of all that happened. She means me being an orphan, he said. We liked Melbourne. It is a big town. Next week, we're going to Brisbane to stay with Bob again and his wife. She wrote a nice letter. They'll meet us at the station. Uncle Steve, Gert, and the children send their love. So does Mabel and your ever-loving. Then she says I needn't worry about money. It's lasting very well. Then she hopes I got a woman who will work. She says the young ones don't clean proper nowadays.
There was a long silence then. Do you think it's a nice letter?
She always writes like that.
It makes me want to be sick. She never had any real education. It's not the English, it's her nasty, mean mind.
She took me in. She certainly did. She took you in and she's gone on taking you in. She's made an absolute fool out of you.
Thank you very much.
Well, she has. Oh, you're right, as per usual.
Don't see that. I put down my knitting and closed my eyes.
She never bossed me about half as much as you do.
I don't boss you. I try to teach you.
You teach me to despise her and think like you. And soon you'll leave me and I'll have no one at all.
Now you're pitying yourself.
It's the one thing you don't understand. You only got to walk into a room, people like you, and you can talk with anyone. You understand things, but when... Oh, do shut up! You're ugly enough without starting to whine.
I picked up my knitting and put it away. When I looked round, he was standing there with his mouth open trying to say something. And I knew I'd hurt him. I knew he deserves to be hurt, but there it is, I've hurt him. He looked so glum. And I remembered he'd let me go out in the garden. I felt mean. I went to him and said I was sorry and held up my hand, but he wouldn't take it. It was queer. He really had a sort of dignity. He was really hurt. Perhaps that was it. And showing it. So I took his arm and made him sit down again. And I said, I'm going to tell you a fairy story. Once upon a time, I said, and he stared bitterly, bitterly at the floor. There was a very ugly monster who captured a princess and put her in a dungeon in his castle. Every evening he made her sit with him and ordered her to say to him, You are very handsome, my lord. And every evening she said, You're very ugly, you monster. And then the monster looked very hurt and sad and stared at the floor. So one evening the princess said, If you do this thing and that thing, you might be handsome. But the monster said, I can't. I can't. The princess said, Try. Try. But the monster said, I can't. I can't. Every evening it was the same. He asked her to lie and she wouldn't. So the princess began to think that he really enjoyed being a monster and very ugly. Then one day she saw he was crying when she told him for the 50th time that he was ugly. So she said, You can become very handsome if you do just one thing. Will you do it? Yes, he said. At last, he would try to do it. So she said, Then set me free. And he set her free. And suddenly, he wasn't ugly anymore. He was a prince who'd been bewitched. And he followed the princess out of the castle, and they both lived happily ever afterwards. I knew it was silly as I was saying it. Fay. He didn't speak. He kept staring down. I said, Now it's your turn to tell a fairy story. He just said, I love you. And yes, he had more dignity than I did then. And I felt small, mean. Always sneering at him, jabbing him, hating him and showing it. It was funny. We sat in silence facing each other, and I had a feeling I'd had once or twice before, the most peculiar closeness to him. Not love or attraction or sympathy in any way, but linked destiny. Like being shipwrecked on an island, a raft, together. In every way not wanting to be together, but together. I feel the sadness of his life, too, terribly. And of those of his miserable aunt and his cousin and their relatives in Australia. The great, dull, hopeless weight of it. Like those Henry Moore drawings of the people in the tubes during the Blitz. People who would never see, feel, dance, draw, cry at music, feel the world, the west wind. Never be in any real sense. Just those three words said and meant. I love you. They were quite hopeless. He said it as he might have said, I have cancer. His fairy story. October 31st. Nothing. I psychoanalyzed him this evening. He would sit so stiffly beside me. We were looking at Goya's etchings. Perhaps it was the etchings themselves. But he sat, and I thought he wasn't really looking at them, but thinking only of being so close to me. His inhibition, it's absurd. I talked at him as if he could easily be normal. As if he wasn't a maniac keeping me prisoner here, but a nice young man who wanted a bit of chivying from a jolly girlfriend. It's because I never see anyone else. He becomes the norm. I forget to compare. Another time with GP. It was soon after the icy douche, what he said about my work. I was restless one evening. I went round to his flat about 10. He had his dressing gown on. I was just going to bed, he said. I wanted to hear some music, I said. I'll go away, but I didn't. He said, it's late. I said I was depressed. It had been a beastly day, and Caroline had been so silly at supper. He let me go up, and made me sit on the divan, and he put on some music and turned out the lights, and the moon came through the window. It fell on my legs and lap, through the skylight. A lovely, slow, silver moon. Sailing. And he sat in the chair on the other side of the room, in the shadows. It was the music. The Goldberg variations. There was one towards the end that was very slow. Very simple. Very sad. But so beautiful, beyond words or drawing or anything but music. Beautiful there in the moonlight. Moon music. So silvery. So far. So noble. The two of us in that room, no past, no future. All intense deep, that time only. A feeling that everything must end. The music, ourselves, the moon, everything. That if you get to the heart of things, you find sadness forever and ever, everywhere. But a beautiful silver sadness. Like a Christ face. Accepting the sadness, knowing that to pretend it was all gay was treachery. Treachery to everyone sad at that moment. Everyone ever sad. Treachery to such music, such truth. In all the fuss and anxiety and the shoddiness and the business of London, making a career, getting pashes, art, learning, grabbing frantically at experience, suddenly this silent, silver room, full of that music. Like lying on one's back as we did in Spain, when we slept out, looking up between the fig branches into the star corridors, the great seas and oceans of stars. Knowing what it was to be in a universe. I cried. In silence. At the end he said, now can I go to bed? Gently. Making fun of me a little bit. Bringing me back to earth. And I went. I don't think we said anything. I can't remember. He had his dry little smile. He could see I was moved. is perfect tact. I would have gone to bed with him that night, if he'd asked, if he'd come and kissed me. Not for his sake, but for being alive's. End of side 12.